Access number 12502, Reel 9.
Field Marshal Lord Bramwell, Reel 9.
Rather ponderous attacks. The most successful part of the whole Battle of Exstrom was the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders doing an infiltration attack through the Bocage country without any preliminary bombardment at all, and infiltrating through the thick country almost in single file, and making about 4 or 5 miles or even more, and getting right deep into the enemy positions, and being able to then retain their position there. And that was one of the interesting things that had come out and shown that the, what I call the formal partridge drive with a preliminary bombardment to give away your thing is not necessarily the way of making, using your infantry and making ground. So that was one of the things that came out. And then, of course, the whole question of the where Epsom reached was largely a question of the perception of the various commanders about how vulnerable they were going to be. I think that they probably went over to the defensive in Epsom rather quicker than they really need have done, because they felt that somehow they were going to get a very large amount of counterattacks coming in them, and they wanted to be properly balanced. They might have made a bit more progress if the determination had been there to press on and follow through what they'd already achieved.
It appears in retrospect that one of the reasons why they stopped too soon and why they probably withdrew from Hill 112 when they might have held on there was that they overestimated the German capacity for counterattack, but I think also possibly they underestimated the sheer power of the coordinated artillery that could be brought to bear to break up such counterattacks.
Well, this makes a very good point. I think that the old adage, artillery wins battles, was never true, more true than there. If the Germans had been able to attack with all those armoured divisions uninterrupted, we would have indeed had a very big problem in our hands. But a mixture of our air force attacking them before they really reached their assembly areas and in their assembly areas, and the artillery, the enormous weight of artillery coming down when they actually started the attack, this in most cases broke these attack up before they came right up to infantry weapon range.
It does also seem that, certainly in more recent years, Epsom has been rather neglected as a battle, whilst Goodwood has been emphasised.
I think that Goodwood provides a fascination, because people sort of see it, to some extent, the other way round, in the terms of a Russian attack across the North German plain, where you would have expected a large weight of armour on a comparatively wide front coming in behind a terrific weight of fire support. And in Goodwood, of course, this is exactly what happened. The enormous weight of fire support largely being provided by Bomber Command on the Borgibus Ridge. But the lessons, I think, from defenders' lessons from that was, if by any chance the fire support lifts too early or the attackers run out of fire support, you can do a great deal of damage by well-sighted, mutually supporting positions in woods and villages and a mobile defence in depth. And that is exactly how the Germans held up 3 British armoured divisions from really getting established on the top of the Borgibus Ridge.
In some ways, this seems to resemble what they were doing on the Western Front in 1917. A different scale of mobility. That around Ypres, for example, they had a network of mutually supporting machine gun posts and redoubts, with the storm troops acting as a local reserve for counterattack on foot.
These were the Germans at
the Germans in
when we were trying to break out at Passchendaele and
exactly
places
so.
Like that.
Yes.
Mm.
And they seem to have updated the concept, given the defensive zone a much greater depth.
Depth, that's right.
And put tanks and mobile infantry.
I hope these were all lessons that we were learning at that time. And certainly when I was commanding a division in Germany, we were indeed trying to put some of those things into operation. Holding lightly in front, getting the measure of where the attacks were coming, trying to canalise the movement in certain directions, and then having a series of killing areas from concealed areas, and then prepared to use the ground and go back and do it again somewhere else, and keep your mobility.
Of course, the
and use the ground to your advantage, and particularly things like reverse slopes and back ends of villages and places where you couldn't be shot off the front of the villages or off the forward slopes, where you would be most vulnerable. I think British defence has always tended to favour, for some reason I can't understand, the forward slope, because they feel comforting that they can see for miles ahead of them. But of course, the further you can see, the more the enemy can see you. And if they have the large amount of firepower, you can be destroyed before you can actually use your weapons.
That's interesting because, of course, the Duke of Wellington was famous for occupying reverse slopes, wasn't he?
Absolutely. He was the master. And, Waterloo was and other places too. But Waterloo was a typical case in point, and he got them all back, got them lying down on the ground behind the Salcombe Road, so that most of this great cannonade went right over their heads. And by the time the great cavalry charges and the infantry columns had come up, negotiated the sunken road, had people in front, skirmishers and artillery, horse artillery, breaking up and disrupting these columns and cavalry charges, when they eventually emerged, there were the British squares largely intact, ready to deal with them. It was absolutely, it is a classic example, and I've never known why the British Army have never really quite learnt that message, in the same way as the Germans have.
The German behaviour in Normandy frequently seemed to be that rather than actually occupying the highest ground from which they could obtain observation or domination, they would occupy less obtrusive ground nearby from which they could dominate that high ground with artillery and mortars.
I'm sure that's
right. And perhaps have a few observation and listening posts.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And the Epsom is a good case in point, because the front of Epsom was held by quite a weak German engineer battalion who disrupted the attack and got the general line. But the defence was always held further back, and they used their weapons to cause great casualties. When, with relief, the various units said, "We've now arrived on our objective and captured it," that was when their trouble started. And 112 was a very good case in point.
What do you think was the principal benefit to your students of taking them on these battlefield tours?
I think it was an enormous benefit, because I think it's the reality of what actually happens in war. I think unless you're on the ground and have people explain what happens, it does seem to be quite extraordinary, where you discover that it took 4 hours to get from one side of a field to another side of a field. It's these sort of things which on paper people just don't understand what is actually happening on the ground, and they can see the place and get a feel of what it is and understand why command decisions were made. And I mean, you can theorise, but then you can check your theories against actually what was happening on the ground. So I think it's they've given it up now, I think, at the Staff College, because, of course, the people who made the whole thing live are all dying off and are no longer there. And it becomes then a sort of military history exercise. But, I mean, I think it's still fascinating today, although you haven't actually got anybody who can explain it. It's fascinating to go to the field of Waterloo, of course, and just see why Wellington took certain decisions and why certain decisions were so good and other decisions were bad.
Did you use Colonel H. Byrne's principle of inherent military probability when you were explaining?
To use the what?
Did you use Colonel A.H. Byrne's principle of inherent military probability when you were discussing ground with
I'm not really very conversant with it.
Well, his theory was that if you were on a piece of ground over which a battle had been fought and the sources conflicted in their account of what happened, you should look at the ground to tell you what was most likely to have happened.
Yes. Well, I didn't know that was what it was called. Yes, I mean, obviously. I think, on the whole, the guest artists, we call them, that we got at the Staff College were remarkably candid. They weren't there to justify their own decisions. Enough time had elapsed to say, you know, I made a nonsense of this, and but this is the way it appeared to me at the time. But, of course, you're quite right. I mean, the first reports, and very often the regimental records of things aren't exactly as they had. They may have been written in good faith. They may have been slightly glamorized for various reasons. But my experience in war is that things are never as they've first appeared. But I think by taking the various collateral, you'll get a pretty good idea of what happened. But one thing sticks out is the thing you've just said, is that 9 cases out of 10, because of our extremely good system, better than any other army in the world, of coordination of artillery support to our frontline troops through our systems of FOOs and so on, where the commanders don't sit back with the guns. Commanders don't sit back with the guns, but are the people who actually direct the artillery fire or who advise the battalion commander, whoever. And this business of being able to amass a tremendous weight of artillery at one place, most of the defensive battles were won by the power of our artillery. There's no doubt about that at all.
Because one of the problems at Goodwood was that the artillery could not be got into position to give forward fire support, wasn't it?
That's right. There was very limited space. Goodwood was on a slightly too confined area. And, of course, the troops intended to move very fast, and they were armoured formations. And when they ran out of the air bombardments, there really wasn't enough left to keep the momentum going because the guns weren't far enough forward to be able to do that, although they had a certain amount of direct fire, of course. But they weren't able to go straight into these series of interlocking villages at the foot of the Borgabus Ridge because as soon as the air bombardment lifted, although the Germans had been put through a tremendous traumas, they came back into action very quickly, and the British found themselves without the artillery to follow up. I think they relied too much on this great bombardment to do the job for them.
Same thing, of course, happened at the Somme, didn't it, in 1916? The idea being the artillery would destroy the German positions and the infantry would merely have to occupy them.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I mean, you've either really got to move very, very close to your artillery fire, or you've got to rely on surprise and hardly have any artillery fire at all until you're actually going in.
Is that why you place such emphasis on the importance of night attacks?
Yes, I think that and sometimes it's the only possible way of doing an attack is by night, and of course it's as they've discovered in the Gulf, of course the main attacks were done by night, and it paid off handsomely because they've got much better equipment now to be able to engage targets at night, and I think you'll get much more shock action, and certainly my experience, a number of attacks that I've done at night with armoured formations and things, met very little opposition because the shock action at night is so much greater than by day.
Of course, you pay a penalty in the prospect of confusion, don't you, or loss of
control? Oh, yes. I mean, you have to have a very simple plan. If the plan is too complicated, you get into terrible muddle.
When you were writing your staff college, your pamphlets that time at the staff college, did your original text get passed more or less intact, or was it revised at all?
Well, it was very interesting. It did get. I wrote the pamphlet, and because it was an official pamphlet, you were supposed to send copies to everybody under the sun, the Church of Scotland, the NAFI, everybody you could think of, and you were expected to sit back and wait for the nitpicking comments which would come in, usually rushing from one side of the boat, because one would say, you know, we want more red, and the other would say we want more black, and they would actually contradict each other. And I thought that this was a good pamphlet. I sent it to Field Marshal Carver, who was my mentor in the world and no mean exponent of tactics and strategy. And he said, I think this is fine. He didn't have any other comments. He said, I think this is fine. And I thought that was good enough, and I got it rushed through as a result. You know, not, I mean, I don't think I'd have got any other worthwhile comments, really. And it seems to have stood the test in time. The trouble is, being the first pamphlet called, you know, I don't think many people read it. Nobody, not many people read pamphlets anyhow. They probably read the infantry, you know, they feel they have to when they go on the tactical trainer. The book at the bottom. They probably read because they want to know what to do. Non-nuclear formation tactics, or they probably read non-nuclear operation battle group tactics, because they say, well, I better, you know, follow what this book says. But this being a philosophical one, but I think it does set the tone, and of course it deals with a lot of things which are highly relevant today. I mean, it defines the various types of warfare, Cold War, limited war, revolutionary operations, and it deals a great deal with the political control, significance of chemical weapons, public opinion, all these things which are very... And it brings up to date the principles of war and spells out what they mean in a modern context. And it also has another chapter which follows those things up, which is called The Prerequisites for Success and the Various Tactical Functions. And I think it's as true today as it was in the 60s. I hope it is, anyhow.
Well, I can certainly assure you that cadets use the definitions in pamphlets. As a way of helping them to write their essays.
Yes, good. Good.
Whether they understand what's in them is another matter. Mm. Now, having spent 3.5 years at the staff college writing the pamphlets and instructing, I think then you said that you were sent off as a brevet lieutenant colonel to be second in command of a battalion.
Now, this is because, you see, I was still only 37. This was in 61, and I wouldn't have been 38 till the end of 61, so I was still 37. Now, nowadays, I suppose one might just have got a battalion, or one would have got a grade one staff job, but it was a bit early in those days. And so I did a year second command of my battalion, which was in Berlin, just at the time the war was going up, so it was very interesting. And I found that very interesting. I was responsible for all the training in the battalion, being the second in command. I had a move back from Berlin to Colchester. I had to prepare the battalion for its new role, which is in the strategic reserve. We had a very active parachute brigadier. And so we did a great deal of training in Ottoman and Salisbury Plain and Libya. We went out to Libya on exercise. And I also headed the advance party back and got to know all the married quarters. And I found being second command fascinating, actually. I enjoyed it very, very much. I had a year there. And then I went to do this job of the reorganization. And it was very interesting because I was posted. I suppose I had some sort of reputation about combat development, forward, future thinking, tactics. And I was posted to a branch called Combat Development 1, and which would have been sort of Whitehall future concepts, which would have been terribly theoretical. But I was posted to it as a lieutenant colonel. This was to be my grade one staff job. And suddenly, Mountbatten said that he wanted a staff officer to head up his team on the reorganization of the Ministry of Defence. And by dint of fate, and Mountbatten was doing the job that I did 20 years later, 25 years later, I was picked out of my job of CD1 and sent to him as Staff Officer, Reorganisation, Minister of Defence, which was a time that I suppose I learnt more about the workings of Whitehall, because I had to take everybody from the War Office, the Admiralty, the Air Ministry, who actually were all in, put them in this one building, interrelate them to each other, so I had to know how the whole machine worked, put them on the right floors according to functions, design all the committee system. Mountbatten was my boss, and I did in fact have an air vice marshal who was ill a lot of the time between me and Mountbatten. But there was no... the whole machinery had to be sort of dissected, analysed and put together again. So of course I learned a tremendous lot about it. And it was far more fascinating than I'd have found being in Combat Development 1.
Combat Development 1, though, would have led on naturally from your pamphlet writing, wouldn't it?
Well, I suppose it would, yes, but, this put me into a new field altogether.
I was going to ask whether you found it something of a shock to the system to be taken from the rarefied heights of Mount Olympus at Camberley and push back into a battalion where you were dealing with matters of day-to-day detail.
Well, one could have done, but I actually much more enjoyed doing things than theorising about them. I found it fascinating. I had a very good commanding officer. We weren't the same sorts of character at all, and he used me, I think, in a way that I could best contribute. And I found it absolutely fascinating, really.
Well, you mentioned that the wall was going up in Berlin when you were there.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, incredible time it was. I arrived just after it had gone up, but we had all the hassle. We had a great OP on the very top of the Reichstag. The Reichstag was completely still gutted in those days, and you reached it by a series of absolute hairy ladders going up in this great vacuum of a building till we got right on the top and looked down the other side. And there were incidents on the wall every day. Somebody was trying to get across, or there was some shooting or something like that. So there was a real confrontational situation on this. And, one never knew what it was going to lead to. And then, of course, the actual access to Berlin was extremely restricted and restrained. I mean, the Russians were being very awkward. And indeed, we weren't there when everybody remembers where they were when President Kennedy was shot. And we'd come back from Berlin then. But, of course, I was amazed that, we were there. Not when President Kennedy was shot, I'm sorry. We were there in Berlin during the missile crisis, the Cuban missile crisis, And I thought that the Russians would then put, and so did a lot of other people, put the heat on in Berlin in no mean manner. Well, they did put the heat on, but they didn't attack the place. But we never, you know, we thought we might be attacked, and the Americans were convinced they were going to be attacked. I mean, every time my American opposite numbers got up in the morning and strapped their guns on, they reckoned the commies were coming through that goddamn wall the next day.
What did the French think was likely to happen?
What?
The French, what was their view?
Well, the French were always doing their own thing, but, I mean, the French would have, you know, they had their own zone in Berlin, and, you know, we were all geared to take up defensive positions and put up some sort of show.
Did the French show signs of thinking there was a possibility or a likelihood of a Russian attack?
Well, the Americans were much the most obvious in thinking it. I mean, I wasn't quite certain that they would actually attack. What I thought they would do is cut the whole place off, and we'd be in a Berlin airlift situation again. And they never quite cut it off. They made it very awkward getting through the corridor, but they never quite cut it off.
How did they make that awkward then?
Oh, because they held you up at roadblocks. You had to give in whole lists of who you were, what stores, that they would look in all the trailers and count all the soldiers and recount all the soldiers. And, you know, you had to submit when you were going down into the western zone, exactly when you were going through, and you weren't allowed to stop, of course, on the way. And there was tremendous. It took you an hour or so to get through a checkpoint, even if you had all the documents right.
So the same sort of tricks as they'd used in the earlier blockade.
Yes, but of course then they cut off all air supply. We never had the air supply cut off. But it was fascinating, and, you know. And then, of course, the contrast between West Berlin and East Berlin was incredible.
Did you go over into East Berlin?
Yes. But you were allowed to go in under very, so you had to wear a uniform, and, you know, it was a
flag patrol system.
That's right. Mm.
How did your soldiers respond to the prospect of high level of tension and possibility of fighting?
Oh, I think they were very good soldiers indeed, and very good. Of course, it wasn't only that. I mean, we did the big parades in the stadium. We once, during my time there, went down into the Federal Public to do our training and came back. So it wasn't all that, but they'd have given a good account of themselves. They were good battalion.
What sort of positions did you prepare then for a defence?
Well, that was the trouble. We weren't able to prepare the positions. I mean, we knew where we had to go, and we would have got into the buildings and so on, but we weren't able to do any preparation for fear of causing alarm and despondency amongst the Berlin. So, I mean, all we did was we did very low-level recces. We knew exactly where we were going to, what obstacles we were going to use and so on. But we didn't do much preparation of positions.
Had the soldiers done a lot of training in street fighting techniques?
No, they hadn't done very much training in street fighting. When we went down into the West Germany, we did various exercises, which include a little street fighting, and we did a lot of theoretical street fighting, but we weren't able to do any training in street fighting. I mean, I don't think it was assumed that one brigade, which is all we were, was going to hold up the Russians for very long. It would merely be making a token gesture. But, of course, the trouble was that we had to make a token, would have had to make a token gesture.
Well, there is a tradition, isn't there, of fighting to the last, which comes from Calais in 1940.
Well, certainly they did extremely well. But of course, there was a real. They went there for a specific purpose, to prevent Guderian's armour coming up and behind the Dunkirk evacuation. They were there to hold up for as long as they possibly could. But of course, the Russians in East Germany were a good deal stronger than the Guderian's armoured spearheads up there. They would have done their duty. whatever their duty was.
What sort of chaps had you got in the battalion at that time? Because this is now again a time when national servicemen have faded away, isn't it? And the soldiers were presumably all full-time
volunteers. When did when the national service went in?
The last national servicemen went through in 1961, 62.
Yes, that's right. We were just making the changeover, because this was 62. Mm. Well, I think it was. I've commanded in both, and of course, there's no doubt about it that it was very, very much easier and more efficient commanding. In you see, towards the end, national service was going, and Suez was a particularly difficult time. There we had this mixture. We had a three-way mixture: national servicemen, who were counting the days to going out, a few regulars who were slightly looked down upon by the national servicemen, you know, rather idiots that they should want to stay on. And we had reservists who were very bobbery indeed, of course, who had been brought out for the Suez operation, kept hanging around for a long time. And it wasn't an easy mixture at all. By the time we came to Berlin, we were getting many more regulars. And it was a very, very much more efficient affair.
Did they come from any particular area of the country, the soldiers who were in this battalion in Berlin?
Well, we were the 60th Rifles, the King's Royal Rifle Corps, and we were very much a London regiment. Very much a London. They all came from, I would say all, you had a few came probably from the Isle of Wight because of Winchester, a few from Hampshire, the odd Geordie, the odd Scouse, but by and large they came from the tight area of East London, East Ham, West Ham, Kentish Town, Bethnal Green, Tower Hamlet, all those areas. They were real Cockneys.
So street fighting wouldn't have found them?
No, they were very, very quick on their feet.